We're on page 5 of our syllabus. I'm sorry, page 4, top of the page. And we're looking at this anthropological survey of different family arrangements. We look at marital residence, that is where the couple lives after they get married. In some cultures, patrilocal residence is called, which is simply the fancy way of saying the couple lives in the husband's community, maybe in the husband's house. This is what you find in the Bible, both Old and New Testaments. This was a common practice. That is, a man lived where he lived, usually as a part of an extended family, his father if he's still alive, brothers, uncles, and then he went to get a wife. And the wife came to live where the husband did. You recall, of course, the classic story of this is Rachel and Isaac. Rebecca and Isaac, I'm sorry. You recall that they went and got a wife and brought her to him. Now, the other, of course, the version of this is the matrilocal residence, where they live with her people, which is less common. You don't find that as practiced less in the world. Now, those are variations in this regard, generally reflect economic conditions as well as other social factors. That is, I'm just pointing out to give a background to our own thinking about our families. This has been dissolved pretty much in our culture. We're at least a generation and a half or two generations away from either one. As you probably well know, that now couples live pretty much where their work is. Both patrilocal and matrilocal arrangements held sway, mainly patrilocal, even in our Western culture in America, while America was primarily an agricultural world. That is, and you can still see traces of this in the Midwest and other parts of the country, where there'll be a large farm, and the son, if there's only one son, then he will, in some cases they have in the past, he would get a wife and they would live in the farmhouse and take care of his parents until they died, and the farm would be his. More often, they would take some land on the farm and build their own house. He would bring his wife, and he would farm with his father until his father retired or died, and then he would take over the farm. And that was a very common thing. Now, especially since World War II, with the heavy industrialization of America, and with the decline of the farm, the family farm. What happens now, generally speaking, is that unless the son is in business with the father, or in some cases, if the son-in-law goes into business with the father, which is often done, except for that, what normally happens is that the couple lives wherever they're working. Now, another element in this of marital residence is the cultural expectation or the cultural desire. That is, whereas at one time, and for most of the world, and most of the history of the world, it has been considered common that the bride would become a part of the larger family of the husband, sometimes move in with the parents or live very close to them, or in some cases the family of the bride. It is now often considered not desirable. As you know, there's an old joke, a standard joke in Western civilization, is the mother-in-law jokes, and the problems of getting along with in-laws. And some people have very excellent experiences with in-laws, and some have very negative experiences, and some neither here nor there. But the question comes up in studies of family life, whether it is desirable, for other than economic reasons, to live with or very close to either set of parents. Now, and often there's a tension here created between parents and children, Parents want their children. Parents love their children. They spent 17 or 18 years bringing up the children. They want the children to live near them. Well, that's fine, except that often that's impossible. And often, you realize that when America was primarily rural, the chances were that the husband and wife would come from the same community. So they'd go to his folks on one Sunday and her folks the next. Both live in the same county. In fact, in my father's time, that was the common arrangement. So there was not really this problem. But when you have one set of parents lives in Florida, another one lives in Tennessee, or one lives in California and one lives in Pennsylvania, because kids meet in college or travel because of the military or whatever reason, then you got a problem. Sometimes. And are you going to live with or near the father's, the husband's parents or the wife's parents? And often there's a lot of hard feelings, very hard feelings. And we're going to come back to this later when we talk about the difference between closeness and dependence. But I'll just say here that families who have raised their children to be emotionally dependent upon them, many parents do this. They don't mean to, but they do it. Some mean to, but most don't. Then what happens is that the parents then are emotionally dependent upon the children, and if the child, whether it be a son or a daughter, chooses not to live in their town or even in their state, or maybe can't live, they view that as betrayal. And it really causes a lot of problems in families. It has destroyed marriages. And I have several brothers, and one of my brothers had to give up a real opportunity in a state in the West, a marvelous opportunity, because his wife simply would not stand to live except in the same town with her mother. And to save his marriage, he just had to do it. Well, I may be going too far to save his marriage, but she just simply was not going to be happy. Her mother wasn't going to be happy. So it creates that kind of tensions. So there's a desire, what I'm saying is this, it's very complex. Some parents don't want their children to live in another state or even in another town. And sometimes the children want to, and sometimes they don't. Sometimes they can, and sometimes they can't. And so it's very complex to try to sort this out if it needs to be sorted out. Tensions are somewhat alleviated by modern transportation and telephones. If it weren't for that, it would be a lot worse. That is, often parents make up for this loss, and children, they both desire to live in the same area. If they can call once a week or regularly, and if they can see them, it's one thing to live in. You realize it was very common in frontier when America was moving west that a couple in the east would leave their parents and go to Oregon or California with the expectation of never seeing them again. Well, that was helped by when the railroad finally got through to the west. But now, with modern transportation, especially air traffic, where you can get on a plane 3 or 4 hours, be there, that it eases that tension somewhat. But it's still there in some families. And it's very natural. Parents, I'm that way. My wife and I are that way. We would like our children to all live in Orlando for the rest of their lives, and all the grandchildren. But we are realistic. We know that that's not going to work. Not in this world. Now, and parents must be careful not to make children feel guilty. How can you leave me? Now, often this is affected. This matrilocal business is affected by such things as the health of parents. I know many cases where children have lived away from their parents until the parents get very old, sick, one of them dies, and then they feel an obligation to move back. Often they have to quit a good job and move back so they can be with their parents.
when they're failing in health.
There is the question then of, and I'll just lay out the decision of the issue. You can make your own decision on it if you need to make a decision on it. But my general opinion is that with the modern world being what it is, that I recommend a healthy distance between a married couple and either parent for the first few years at least. By healthy distance, I think about it. I know my wife and I during our early years, this was just, we didn't plan it this way, it just worked out that way. We were about 125 miles from either parent. Just enough, it was a long distance call. She didn't pick up the phone every 5 minutes. But it was interesting. It was close enough we could go on holidays, you know, and special times and see them without too much trouble. And yet, they weren't close enough to involve themselves in our lives. Not that either set of parents ever tried. They did not. They made, you know, that was never a problem. But it was kind of nice. And I think it helps independence. I got a phone call the other night from a lady in Indiana. She was crying. And she had seen a tape that was made at Hillsborough, either at the family camp, I didn't quite get this straight, or at couples retreat. I was up there twice, the Hillsborough campgrounds in Ohio. And anyway, they made videotapes, and she and her husband were having trouble, and she had seen this videotape, and so she went to the trouble of locating me and calling me up for advice. I told her I'm not into prevention. I'm into cure. I'm into prevention. And I'm not a trained counselor. I don't know if I do much of that. But a real part of the problem was that her parents had interfered, and she had let them in the marriage. Now, it wasn't all the problem, but they had she would side with her parents against her husband, and she would tell her parents everything her husband said, some of the intimate things that nobody ought to be told, and she just never. She never left home, as it were, and so she had recognized it now. But I think that, for that and other reasons, in my opinion, the marriage cannot be saved. And I think he was guilty of a lot of worse things from what she said, because you just get one side of it, or something like that. But she admitted that was a real problem. She had done that. Well, some parents and children, the married children, live at great distances, and the parents still interfere. And I see other cases where they live in the same town and did not interfere. So it's not always tied to distance. Often if a parent is going to interfere, they'll work it out somehow. And if children, now and the other side of this is that children often don't want to leave home emotionally. I'll tell you, fellas and ladies, somebody you're interested in, your fiancé, is a mama's boy or a mama's girl, you better think two or three times before you marry them. Because it's not going to get better after marriage, it's going to get worse. That is, if they say, well, I'll have to ask what mine is. Now, there's a difference between being close and being dependent. Now, we're going to talk about that later, I have to repeat myself. But there are many, and I'm not talking about being close, I'm talking about being emotionally dependent. In other words, people, children who will not or cannot take responsibility for their own lives. Understand? So they keep handing that responsibility back to their parents. Well, that's fine for a 16-year-old. That's the parent's job. But by the time a child is old enough to get married, it's time for them to take responsibility for them. Not that they don't need help from parents sometimes, financial, or other kind. Not that they don't get help. Not that help is not offered. But there's a difference between being helped and not taking responsibility for your own life. And we know the difference, don't we? Well, we should. And as I say, it's very complex. There are the feelings of, in some cases, and this gets further complicated by divorce. We might be close to one parent, not another, or you got two sets of parents on one side. That is, you got a mother and her husband and the father and his wife, and it really gets sticky. Family relationships are very important. Well, we introduced to that here with this thing of marital residence. Have any I've kind of wandered all over the landscape here. Do you have any questions on this? Comments? Observations? You can talk if you want to. Well, we come now to the stability of marriages. Again, an anthropological survey. In marriage of free choice, divorce is frequent before the first child is born. And our culture has marriage of free choice. We choose to get married, we choose to divorce. It is not uncommon at all now, tragically, for couples to be married in November and divorced by April. Marriages of a year or two are very common. But after the child is born, then things are changed. Well, I'll get to that in a minute. This is seriously affected by religious conviction or the absence thereof. People with strong religious faith stay married longer and marry fewer times. This is simply a statistic than people of little or no religious faith. By the way, a lot of people would get divorced who aren't divorced. This is sad to say, because divorce is rampant in our culture, our society. There would be even more divorces. I'm convinced the divorce rate would be 75% if it weren't for the fact that lawyers get involved and there's all kinds of financial considerations, and you get court cases and alimony, child support. And I've heard men say this, that the only reason they're still married is they cannot afford a divorce. In fact, this lady who called, what her husband had told her. They said he'd found another woman, and he'd been unfaithful, according to her, down through the years. But he said, we can't afford a divorce. You know, I can't afford to support two households, and so that is involved often. What I'm saying is that the divorce rate doesn't reflect the real problem in marriage. After children are born, I say in the syllabus here, marriages tend to last longer. That is, children are a bond between parents. Now, this does not mean that the couples are happier, but that they have or develop, misspelled, a sense of moral obligation toward their children. That it's the old cliche of staying together for the children. And it's a very common thing to see a couple who are married until the last child gets out of high school, and then they get a divorce. You know, they stay together to get the children raised. Well, the last child gets out of college. We've met our obligation. As soon as the kids are raised, he says, I'm going my own way, or she says, I'm kicking the bum out. And they do. And they do. That is, so the presence of, the absence of money in the presence of children are a restraining force on the divorce rate. It's humiliating to say, but it's true. Where marriages involve a bride price in less technological societies, third world societies, where marriages involve a bride price, divorce is rare. Why? Because, again, other kinds of financial difficulties. Laws governing alimony often affect the incidence of divorce. I've already said that. A divorce is expensive in all kinds of ways. Where strong religious convictions exist, marriages not only last longer, but marriages are more successful. People work from a worldview that creates more happiness. Let me tell you what the basic, gets back to what we covered earlier in our earlier lectures. The basic reason for this is that religious faith tends to create a person, a mind, or a mindset that is left less, can't speak today, that is not as selfish as other people. I don't use the word selfish because that word has a light meaning. We say the word selfish, we think of a little child who will not share his toys with his playmate. You say he's selfish. So the word kind of has a trivial connotation in our language. So I use the word selfish. It's much more profound than simple childish selfishness. It is a overwhelming, fundamental, dominant concern for oneself. Well, a strong religious view, not just Christianity, other religions, but
other religious views tend to create, not often, some and some don't. At least, well, we're on safe ground in saying that Christianity, at least, the real thing, creates a, it restrains that profound selfism to which we are all subject because of sin, and therefore makes marriages work better. Selfishness is poison to a marriage. And the sad thing about that is that it doesn't take both people don't have to be selfish, it just takes one, and it can ruin a marriage. By the way, people really are, it's amazing, it's selfish. I almost said something I didn't, but some time back, I won't tell you when because you might figure out where it was. I was having a family seminar in the past, and I was teaching these principles all weekend, and the preacher, we're having a little meal, luncheon or banquet, or I forget what it was, and the preacher, we were sitting there talking, and his wife was sitting at the next table, which is fine, so the ladies were sitting together, the men were sitting together, and she was involved in the conversation, and he decided he needed another glass of iced tea. He made his wife get up, leave her conversation, and go get him some iced tea. And she did it. It's like it was the most natural thing in the world. That's what bothered me more than, I thought, man, you got two legs, you're a big healthy man, get your own iced tea, leave your wife alone. She's talking to other people. She's not your servant. But seriously, it was very natural for him to tell her to, and it was very, and she just did it without, it was very natural, and I just about hit both of them. I wanted to say, what am I doing here? I'm trying to teach these principles, and here's the preacher. That's just selfism. In other words, his wife is there to, you know, so he won't have to get his worthy self up off the chair and walk 30 feet to go get another glass of iced tea. So she has to get up and go get it for him. Now that's just you see what I'm saying? That's just a profound just an attitude. Now how's he going to teach that church, the young couples in that church, to have good marriages when he's that selfish, that selfless? Now there are times when we will, you know, fetch things for each other, but you see what I'm saying? It boils down to the everyday business of making a family work, and that is. It's humiliating to a woman. It should have been humiliating to her. She should have told him, get it yourself, Charlie. Well, his name wasn't Charlie. She should have told him that. Well, she didn't. And she shouldn't have told him in front of other people. But the fact that he would just expect her to do that. You know, I'm sitting here and, honey, go fetch me this. Now, it's one thing for a woman who is her part of her work to prepare the meals and have them on the table, you know, at supper time. But for him, a man just to sit around and lounge and make his wife be his, you know, his personal servant kind of business. Women don't, that is degrading to a woman. Is it not? And I have too much respect for my wife to, now if I, you know, there are situations where I say, honey, you're coming by the kitchen.
She says, go get it yourself.
We had a man, and this guy was a member of the church. He wasn't an officer of the church. He was from Kentucky, raised. Eastern Kentucky, is raised in the old tradition, and this man's retired now. Good fella, I loved him dearly, but he was a character. He was a real old mountain man, in some ways, a hill man, and he was retired from Fisher Body up in Ohio. But he required his wife. Now get this, he worked the second shift for years and years and years because he wanted it so he could work on his little farm in the mornings, and then go to work in the afternoon. So he stayed on it until he retired. And his wife had to have his meals on the table at a certain time. And his wife was a school teacher. We had been a school teacher. She was educated. And I don't think he had a high school education even, but she had a college degree. Delightful lady. But he required her to not only have his lunch on the table, have his lunch fixed, but to be home every day when he left for work about 2:30. So she could stand and wave goodbye at him. You know, he went by to him, and that was a requirement. She could not go anywhere during the day because she had to be there when he left. He wanted his wife there to hand him his lunch and wave bye-bye. as he drove into the sunset, or drove the Fisher body. Now, that is nonsense. But she did, which is also nonsense. What you had was a mama's boy. That's just a spoiled brat. I don't care how old you are. There is no need for that kind of thing in a marriage. You understand? That is unnecessary selfism. And women do this. There are female versions of this. Well, what I'm saying is that my point is that religious conviction of the Christian faith tends to often, no guarantee, often encourages a kind of worldview that moves the center of attention and affection off of self far enough, often enough, that you can have that a marriage works better. Yes.
Yeah, how far do you carry that? I know God is back home, but that's the way they've all been raised, and that the mother is the servant and the father, And that's how they all are. There are very, very, very few exceptions to that. And how do you, after a while, you can't keep fighting that, or you've got a problem in your marriage at the time. I find that most of the girls finally end up saying, to a certain extent, now they don't give up their whole identity, but to a certain extent, they just say, okay, in order to just shut my mouth and make things go smoother, I'll do it. And they just submit to that.
Yes.
And that's the way everybody is.
But their choice is between destroying their marriage or damaging it seriously and submitting to that kind of humiliation. And I say it's the man's fault, you see. But see, what you've got is an unhappy situation. Anytime you have a marriage where, in order for the marriage to survive, one partner has to degrade themselves, you've got a horrible situation. Now, I'd say it's to their credit if they're willing to, for the sake of the marriage, to submit to that kind of stuff. It's to their credit, but it does not mean it's a happy situation. You realize back in the old days, it's still true. This generation is just dying away. There are parts of Kentucky, Tennessee, and Arkansas where the women don't even eat with the men. They would serve their husbands and then
go back in the kitchen.
Well, there was the old, and I grew up on the tail end of this. There was the old rule was the men ate, the men of the house ate, then the women would eat, and the children would eat. Children ate at the third table. Now, by the time I had been born, the men and women ate together, unless it was crowded. I can remember meals when I was little, when my dad and all my uncles, my grandfather would be at the table, and the women would eat in the kitchen. They'd eat separately. Well, they wouldn't eat because there was too many people. But if there was room, they would eat together. But the children ate second. Today, children, if you've been to a church supper, children often ruin them because they dominate. Parents, weak-minded parents, let them. So children becomes the little bratish kind of thing. But that, it used to be that way. Now, any other questions or comments on this? We're talking about this. Well, this is going to be an overlap with some of the things we're going to say. But we look at these principles here from this viewpoint of anthropology and sociology. Let me say this to you. One of the things we need to begin learning here is that one of the dangers, one of the deadly characteristics of selfism is that we cannot see it for the very reason that we are selfish. A selfish never knows it. You have to hit him with something or often, you understand? They lose their marriage before they know it. That's the danger of it. Now, do not misunderstand me. I'm not talking about the fact, I am not saying, for example, that husbands don't wait on wives sometimes, and wives don't wait on husbands. That's not what I'm saying. What we're saying is that it is a woman bringing her husband something, or a husband bringing her something, or his wife something. That is not the same thing as one person being degraded, having to sacrifice their liberty, as it were, and their personality because you've got this self-centered oaf who may be male or female. And it's like, let me give you an example. I think it's a good home where if you're not eating in the kitchen, when supper's over, everybody grabs their own plate. So we did at our house. Everybody grab your plate and we'll go to the, and I don't help wash dishes, but I bought my wife a very nice dishwasher. She'd rather have the dishwasher in the kitchen than me, and that arrangement suits me perfectly. But I don't think I have a right. In other words, if I'm in a rush, my wife never says anything about it. But I don't think I have a right, just because I'm the man, the husband, to just get up from the table and say, and my wife, she's had as busy a day as I've had, usually, to get up and say, well, it's your business. You carry the plates in.
No.
Now, she doesn't want me in the kitchen messing around, but we have a rule at our house. Whoever's up first makes the coffee. One of the reasons we have that rule is I'm usually up first. My wife loves that rule. And, and being a Christian home, we drink coffee. It's a delight for me. I enjoy that. I enjoy getting by myself. I got an hour or two, I get ready. And when my wife wakes up, I can say, here, I can give her a cup of coffee. Does that make me her personal servant? Does that make me something? I don't think so. I enjoy it. I'll come home at night and I'm tired, and she'll say, hey, I'll be sitting there watching MASH, which I do religiously. And she'll bring me a cup of coffee. She's had the afternoon, she's been home all afternoon. Well, that's a nice arrangement. It's not a matter of we don't do things for people. But this idea of a man sitting back and saying, treating his wife as his personal servant, is simply not, that is bad business. It degrades a woman. Listen, I'll tell you, fellas, if she'll do that, if you'll be that self-centered oaf and she'll be your personal servant, then you don't want her. She's a nerd. I'm serious. If she puts up with it, she's a real jerk. I wouldn't want to live with a woman and have children with a woman who had so little self-respect that she'd let me make her my personal servant.
You're not saying certain things evolve that necessarily wrong. Like, I don't wash dishes, but my wife despises the grocery shop.
No.
It's not something that she has to, but it involves the responsibility.
We're not talking about a division of labor. We're talking about an attitude. Every home has to divide labor. And I think I mentioned this before. I want to make sure we understand this, because this is a very, I did talk about this before, didn't I? Division of labor. Yeah. It's a very important part of a functioning family. That where this division is depends on the chemistry of the family. There are some jobs which in some homes men do, and another home a man would never do, for all kinds of reasons. There's a lot of work. Listen, there's a lot of jobs that I do not do at our house and never do. I know other men who do, but my wife doesn't want me to, and I don't want to. We agree perfectly. In other homes, wives don't mind, they want them to, and they can help. But I do some things other men would not do. You understand? And they would say, well, you don't. In other words, who does the heavy cleaning, who takes care of the yard, who keeps the checkbook, all these things. That is not a male-female matter of competition. That's not what I'm talking about. But it's an attitude. That is selfism that comes across often other ways. For instance, here's selfism. A man who says, well, it's my money, and he treats his wife as if she were a beggar. And he doles it out, making sure she understands that he's being benevolent to her. Oh, Gus, come off it. Listen, in a home, the rule at our house is, no matter who makes it, it's just our money. And my wife, as this is my, she works part-time and I work full-time. And now we pay each other. She pays me, since I pay the bills, that is, I write the checks and keep track of the budget, she would never think of making a big expenditure without checking with me to see if we've got the money. I sent my wife to visit LeAngela, my oldest daughter, last week, and she was going to try to drive up, and her sister couldn't go with her, and I didn't want her driving by herself. She didn't really want to. And we got a real good deal on the airline ticket. I was in Pennsylvania, so she called me long distance to see if she could buy this ticket. She was not asking for permission. to go. She was saying, she was asking, you know, she said, do we have the money? That's a different thing. And I told her, I said, well, you know, she knows that every dollar I make is hers just as much as it is mine. And it's just, you know, and so, but you understand what I'm saying? It's an attitude. It's one thing to check with your partner and say, look, it's not right. It wouldn't be not right for a woman to just go out and spend and say, well, it's my money too. That's selfism in itself. And then destroy the budget. So she checked with me, and I said, well, sure. I'd have said it anyway. She knew I would, you know, if we didn't have it. But I appreciated her being considerate of me, since, you know, she'd go out and spend a couple hundred dollars on a ticket or whatever, or that much. But that's not the same thing as a woman having to come with her hat in her hand. And some, you know, begging for every penny. Now, some men get an ego trip out of that. They think it really. A lot of men think they cannot be the head of the house unless their wife has to beg them for every penny, and so she's sort of on an allowance. That kind of stuff. That's degrading to a woman. It's selfism in a man. You understand? It's one thing for a man to take responsibility for the budget. It's something else for him to treat his wife as if she were a welfare recipient. And many men do it. Women walk around broke all the time, or they, you know. But I think the rule is, if he's broke, then she's broke, then he's broke too. You're broke together. And it's not right for a man, for instance, to go out. It's not right for a woman to take the credit card and just buy whatever she wants and then let him worry about it. Nor is it right for a man to say, well, Friday night's payday, I'll go out with the boys. And a lot of men do this. They go out and drink and carry on with the boys, and then let the wife worry about scrounging up money for rent and groceries and that kind of stuff. You know, so I can't
hear. Is it wrong for them? I know I work with a lady right now who's middle-aged, and her and her husband always have their own separate checking accounts. They both work, and they keep their money separately. She pays certain bills and he pays others. Is that a form of selfishness too?
No, that's just an agreement. It's an attitude. It depends on what basis it's worked out. It sounds like just something they both prefer. Nobody else's business, you see. That's not the same. That's not what I'm talking. Now, if she had to do that in order to protect herself, then I think you got a problem. And many women do that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, then I say she's got a problem. Now, that's unfortunate. He says, my money, I'll do what I want to with it. So in order to have some kind of self existence and identity and a little money to spend, she has to go out and get a job and keep. That's unfortunate. Very bad. Nothing wrong with not getting a job, but to do it for that reason is horrible. It's selfism, you see. But we're going to keep coming back to this. Were there any other questions before we left it or coming? My point, let's remember what we're talking about. We're talking about how the fact that people work from a worldview that creates more happiness if they have a strong religious faith very often, especially the Christian faith. But it certainly gets boiled down to everyday things. People have a conscience also with a religious faith against divorce, and therefore are forced to either tough it out or be more creative in their relationships. This can be good, it can be bad. But toughing it out is better than divorce. That's what I taught under the heading of covenant. But the toughing it out is grim business. I prefer the second, to be creative in the relationships. Okay. In societies, I continue now, in societies where there is considerable community or family pressure to stay married, extramarital sex is often accepted. This is in some cultures. That is, we're talking about why people stay married. If they're not really working, if their marriage isn't working. A lot of marriages that are not working are still in existence. It's too expensive to get divorced. There's children. They're going to stay together for the children. Often tough it out because of a religious conviction, which, again, is commendable, but it's not the desirable alternative. In societies that have a strong ethic against divorce, infidelity is acceptable.
This is a part of the Latin culture, by the way. Both European and in the New World, it's very much a part of the Latin culture, which is Roman Catholic. In Roman Catholic countries that are Latinized. You've had my history courses. Spain, which are for the Latin culture, was fixed. Spain, Portugal, Italy, of course, Sicily, and then of course many Central and South Mexico, Central and South American countries. As opposed to countries that are Roman Catholic but not Latinized, like Poland and Austria, which are Roman Catholic but not Latin. But in Latin, Roman Catholic countries that are Latinized, this is a part of the culture that a woman is, the marriage stays together. Divorce is supposed to be out. A woman is supposed to be faithful to her husband, but the man can do pretty much what he wants. In fact, a man is considered not macho. He's not really considered a man if he can't do two things in the Latin culture. One, if he can't grow a mustache. And two, if he doesn't have something going on the side. I'm serious. You look at it, that's a part of that culture. Mainly the second. And it's winked at. It's looked upon as being... It goes back to the Roman culture. Look at that. In ancient Rome, marriage was highly honored because of inheritance and family lineage considerations. As long as appearances were preserved, marital fidelity was not necessarily held in high regard. There's one thing to have to say. You can't. It's one thing to hold marriage. Now listen to me, students. It's one thing to hold marriage sacred because divorce is out. It's something else to hold marriage sacred and there, because it is sacred, remain faithful in the marriage relationship. So they really hold marriage sacred in an offhand kind of way. This perhaps is the background of the requirement of the pastorals that an elder be a one-woman man. I'll just say that my view that when Paul says to Timothy and elders to be the husband, it doesn't say a husband of one wife. It says literally a one-woman man. Now, of course, the word for wife or woman was the same word. So it's either one wife man or one woman. I don't think he's saying one word about divorce there. There's a very good Greek word for divorce. He didn't say it. Now I think divorce as a requirement for the eldership comes into play under able to rule his house well. A man who couldn't keep his home together obviously has not ruled his house well. So I think divorce is a consideration. But I don't think that statement, a one woman man, husband of one wife, I don't think he's talking about divorce at all. He's talking about, in my opinion, I can't prove this, he's talking about the fact in the Roman culture, in the first century culture, it was considered normal for a man, in fact, he was looked down upon by his fellows if he did not do this, if he did not have a woman on the side, at least one. Or maybe one at a time. Understand? He would have his wife, that was considered acceptable and normal. And it still is in many cultures, like I say, Latin culture. Not just that, but that's very prominent. Any of you have any personal knowledge of that personally? Well, you ever lived in
question was
you ever lived in? You ever lived in communities? It makes it very hard to evangelize people in the Latin culture. It's a very negative factor in evangelizing them. Why? Because they just don't think that way.
In my view, like that.
Oh, yeah.
The home is home, and that's where the wife and the kids are, and outside is the husband's business. That's it.
That's right. Well, this is a parenthetical discussion. What I'm saying is, I think what Paul is saying to Timothy is, an elder, among other things, must be a man who sleeps with his wife and nobody else, no other woman. He's a one-woman man. He's faithful in the marriage. You understand? He's not like the culture.
Like this question.
those cultures, I think I said before, I maybe just rushed over, a woman does not have that privilege. If she has an affair, she's a tramp. A man has an affair, he's a man. Now the church, it's interesting, this is one of the radical differences between the church and the world in the first century, and ought still to be today. It had the same standard for men as it did for women. You got that? That thou shalt not commit adultery, and an elder has to be a one-woman man. You understand that? Well, what I'm saying is that many marriages, so divorce was out, but that doesn't mean you had the kind of, that you would have what we would call a Christian marriage. One more point, then we'll take our break. We look at the child in the family, early and late childhood. Childhood years have been historically brief in most cultures. Economic prosperity expands the childhood years. Now, we may have to take our break before we finish this discussion, but this is very important looking at the background of raising children. Do you realize that children today, the years of where you're early and late childhood, again, this is anthropology, cultural anthropology. Economic prosperity expands the childhood years. Now, by childhood years, we mean years of comparative irresponsibility. Not full irresponsibility. That is lack of, they're not responsible. Irresponsible, that's not really the right word. The years of non-responsibility. Now, let me say that children in this generation, your children, have maximum non-responsibility, although it's interesting, it seems to be shifting slightly back the other way. I'm not sure about that. You want to get that door for me so we don't get the noise in here? And again, it's economics. For instance, children in some cultures cannot be free to play a lot because of the economic necessity of work. Simple as that. But this goes back to ancient history. One of the things that's been found in the ancient Near East, going back to the 3rd millennium BC, are children's toys. Quite fascinating. It's like you can just picture this little Sumerian child with the playing with little chariots, soldiers, like children today play little tanks and soldiers, but then dolls, things in little miniature houses, toys. But children, childhood play years are affected by the requirements of education. But children, I think that one of the things that is a danger is when childhood years of non-responsibility are extended too far into the late teen years. Now, again, you all live at an age when it's hard to, you don't have much of the past to look back on, but I kind of live at a transitional age. I can see, I know about my grandfather, my father, and myself, and my own children. I have knowledge of four generations, limited knowledge of four generations. When my grandfather had a shorter childhood than my father did, and my father and I had a longer childhood than my father, and my children have a longer childhood than I had. That is more years of non-responsibility. That's just mainly economic, and the transition from rural to urban, from the farm to the factory in the city. For instance, my father, when he was in high school, it was during the Depression, and he was a truck driver in high school. He was in almost all the 50 states we ever got out of high school driving a truck, his truck, making a living. It was very common in my grandfather's age. My grandfather just died, my paternal grandfather, two or three years ago. In his day, by the time a boy got to be 13, his father would take him out of school and put him to work. So he became, in effect, by the time he became a teenager, he was a man working full time. I can remember that, of course, you don't remember this, but when I was just starting, when I was in grade school, it was still up to debate whether a guy, whether kids would finish high, or boys especially, would finish high school or not. It was a big thing. It was considered, it was just beginning to be normal for a boy to finish high school. It was very common in my father's day for boys not to finish high school. In fact, it was quite an accomplishment if they did. Their parents were able to keep them in and finish high school. It'd be your grandparents, most of you. Why? Well, because of economic necessity. Guys would drop out and go to work, have to. Often they'd be forced to help support the family. So I had to work more than my son. I had to go to work much more and earlier than my sons did. I had more responsibility in high school, but I had a lot less responsibility than my father had. I'm not begrudging. I'm not saying anything wrong with this. It doesn't mean that the modern generation is any less worthy than the older generation. It's simply what the economic conditions permit. Now, I think the other. Well, we're going to come back to this when we come back to sex education. The bad side of this whole business is that the extended years of non-responsibility have created this artificial animal called a teenager. And teenagers grow up, in our culture today, with the idea that the teen years are time out. They don't count. And they count more than almost any other period of 5 or 6, 7 years. They do, but there's that illusion that what I do now doesn't really count. It doesn't count morally. I'm free. That is, I am not. Many teenagers feel this way. I am not responsible. I'll not become responsible until I'm 20, 21. Then I'll become responsible and I'll be a different person. And they actually think this way. And this, it causes a lot of damage. Every year that idea kills several students here in Florida on spring break. And it's sort of become a cult of non-responsibility. The word is party, and you're free, you know, and you can do. Well, this is they'll say that. In other words, young people today, your generation was taught this. I'm not blaming you. I'm simply explaining. Your generation was taught, whether you bought it or not, I don't know, but you were taught that that you had a right, an intrinsic right, a birthright to several years of non-responsibility. And you say, well, you know, these are the years I've got to do it. I'm a teenager, only a teenager. You know, let's say things like this. I'm only a teenager once, you know, and if I'm going to do it, I've got to do it now. And you've got to try everything once and all this stuff. And it causes a lot of damage, all kinds of ways. A lot of kids have bad memories. They've got to carry around with them like dirty garbage the rest of their lives because somebody sold them that business that it was time out, and they find out that it wasn't time out at all, but it did count. I found out too late in all kinds of ways, to one degree or another. Now, so children's toys are a multi-billion dollar business in America because they have these sacred play years. Now, I'm not against that. I just think we ought to be aware of it and try to strike some kind of balance in our Christian homes. There's children, for one thing. It's one thing for a child. Listen, see, what happens is economic responsibility and moral responsibility tend to go hand in hand if we don't mark the difference. And we always taught our children that while they were not economically responsible, they are morally responsible. Do you have any questions or comments on that?
Is that why this teen years called rebellious years?
Well, we're going to talk more about that later, but yes, it's the idea of another part of the package is that of a sacred right, a sacred responsibility, they have a sacred right to non-responsibility and a sacred obligation to rebel against their parents, which I don't buy. This thing of teenager, you know, there was no such thing as a teenager until World War I. You know that, don't you? The term teenager was first heard in England. in World War One. Then in the '60s, you got this business of the culture of the generation gap, or that generation gap. It creates a part of this myth, this demonic myth, that the children and their parents aren't supposed to be on the same wavelength while they're in high school. And if you're on the same wavelength, with your parents, sometimes you're weird. A teenager who likes their parents too much is thought to be weird in the youth culture. And if they get along, fine. And parents who like teenagers. I understood. I love teenagers. It's going to be one of my biggest heartaches is when I run out of teenagers. I love teenagers. I kill them regularly. But I love teenagers. I like other people's teenagers. I think they're tremendous. And we have never in our house bought this idea of the culture gap. The generation gap. That's a myth. Not that you don't have natural tensions of growing up. But it's one thing to have the natural tensions that are created with growing up and assuming your own responsibility for your own life gradually. But it's something else to say, as soon as I become a teenager, then I'm on one side of everything, my parents are on the other. And to set up an adversary, that is, to set up an adversary situation.
Is there a cutoff date now? In the 60s, when there was a generation gap, anybody over 30 was it.
Yeah.
They became part of the establishment.
Well, that's changed a lot now because of the materialism of the modern society. People are going, they join the institution, what they used to call the institution. The establishment. They join the establishment earlier now for the bucks. We're talking about these years of non-responsibility. We'll come back to this from another direction. The disciplining of children has been the subject of the widest variation, and we're going to talk about that later. I said we just note here that cultures have disciplined their children in all kinds of different ways, some successfully, some not so often. The disciplining of children reflects culture. And last of all, the puberty ritual or rite of passage is widespread. I give examples: the Jewish bar mitzvah, the Roman Catholic confirmation. And this is healthy, by the way. I like this rite of passage deal. Interesting thing. Cultures seem to have done this naturally. That is to mark a transit, to mark our transitions. And the bar mitzvah is one of the most pointed ways. The son becomes the son of the covenant, son of the law. In our house, we always made it a hallelujah day when our children became teenagers, going from childhood into the early adult years. I always bought my daughters a dozen roses. I always only had two. I claimed because I'd spent so much money on my daughters buying contact lenses and cheerleading outfits, I figured I had the right to give them their first dozen roses. So that's a father's prerogative. We always have birthday parties. We'll talk about that later too. But we didn't make a big thing. The boys turn to be 13. Now it's harder for boys. But we make a big hoopla now that you're a teenager. Make speeches and act a fool. It's kind of a rite of passage. By the way, I would like to see the church. The churches that practice confirmation, they have this built in. I want to give you a challenge. Your generation to create. I think your generation. I challenge your generation. I began to say this several years ago, and it's really worked out. I began to challenge it, not because I said it. It just worked out that way. I challenge younger generation to write better music for the church than the church has had in the past. And I think they're doing it in some way. Some of the modern youth music, contemporary gospel music, I call it, I don't know proper names for it, stinks. But much of it is excellent. And I think there's some real, I think the music for the next year, for the coming generation is going to be better than the music of the past. That is, that's sung in the church on a daily basis. There has been great music in the past, and some of it's not been used. Maybe some of the challenges to go back and get some of the unused great music and use that too. But another challenge I would give you is, I'd like to see the church, that we who don't practice infant baptism, don't have confirmation, is to work out some kind of ritual for the church, for our young men and young women, for Christians, kind of a Christian bar mitzvah.
You have to memorize the restoration syllabus.
Could do that, yeah. I'm serious. Or you could really, or maybe not done in the church, or Christian families could have a, you could give it a Latin name or a Hebrew name or a Greek name or something, really make it special. That's something that's a challenge. Well, let's move on now to part three of the of our study. This is the boring, keep in mind, I want you all to know this is boring. I told you it was boring. I'm doing my best to keep my promise. But, or am I not? This, you fellows are, you know, if I get too, if it gets too interesting, you be sure and warn me, oh, you three fellows, okay? So I mean, don't fall asleep again. That's not what I mean. But look at cultural aspects of marriage in the ancient world. Now this should be interesting to us, if boring, for two reasons. Number one, because of our interest in biblical studies, and the Bible is a product of the ancient world. And secondly, for a perspective on modern marriages. So I introduce it this way. One of the more important and difficult areas of biblical interpretation is that of women and marriage. In particular, the need to discern which elements are cultural, temporary, and variable, and which ones are transcultural and universal. For instance, the Bible says the husband is the head of the wife. Is that cultural or is that universal? Well, we'll see. That's an example of what I'm talking about. This section surveys historical and cultural aspects of betrothal and marriage in the ancient societies that were contemporary, underline, that were contemporary with the biblical writers, and offers in part a biblical perspective on women and marriage. Okay, first of all, we come to preparations for marriage. And this is very important to us. We may not be all excited about this historical stuff. In ancient Mesopotamia, the world of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, marriages, as you well know, were arranged by parents. The Code of Eshnunah, you recall it's one of the three great legal codes, Eshnunah, Lipit Ishtar, and Hammurabi. The Code of Eshnunah, so back to 1900 BC, invalidates a marriage that lacked the permission of the bride's parents. She just went out and got married without their permission, and it was annulled, invalidated. Old Babylonian texts indicate that the consent of the bride was not necessary. Now, what actually happened, was the consent of the bride usually sought? The answer is yes, as far as we know. This was not a cold-hearted, sterile thing, usually. The arrangements were made by the parents, but they would consult with the daughter and with their children, although the parents had the final say. In Egypt, girls were married between the ages of 12 and 14. In the ancient world, it was considered by the time a woman was physically capable of having children, she was ready for marriage. I think I said that before. Young men between 14 and 20. Judging from the many Egyptian love songs, romantic love played an important role in the choice of a life mate. Now, this does not negate the fact that in the ancient world, marriage was for the purpose of procreation, and often for the maintenance of property arrangements rather than for love and companionship, although the latter often developed. So was romance absent from these arranged marriages? The answer is no. It came in often, it came in sometimes before the wedding, after the wedding. Romantic love has always been desirable. I put this in the syllabus because I know it turned you on. This is one of the oldest love poems extant. Goes back to Egypt. I give you the citation. You're familiar with D. Winton Thomas's documents in Old Testament time. This is a love poem from 1300 to 1000 BC. It's hard to date. And I just wish that one of you had brought your violin to play while we read this. But this is ancient romance. The voice of the swallow speaks, saying, "The land is bright.
What of thy way? Prithee, do not, O bird, scold me. I have found my brother. Brother, sister meant, it's a literal translation, but the word brother doubled for your sweetheart. Sister, same thing. Not related. Understand, the word brother, sister has a double meaning. I have found thee, my brother, I say my sweetheart, in his bed, and my heart is pleased evermore. We have said to one another, I shall not go far away while my hand is in thy hand. That's lovely, isn't it? Hallmark never said anything prettier than that. I shall not go far away while my hand is in thy hand. She's talking about her husband. Husband as sweetheart. I shall stroll about, being with thee in every beautiful place. Could you see this young couple married, walking around, holding hands? 3,000 years ago, whatever it was. Yeah, so over 3,000 years ago. I shall stroll about, being with thee in every beautiful place. He has made me the chief of his lovely women. I just want to, you know. Can't have everything. He has made me the chief of his lovely women, lest he should wound my heart. Is it polygamy? So I'm his favorite. Well, they knew how to do things back then, right? Here's another example. The love of my sister, I like this one. The love of my sister, sweetheart, is on. Now, this is probably not a wife. The love of my sister is on the yonder side of the stream in the midst of the fish. A crocodile stands on the sandbank. Yet I go down into the water. I venture across the current. My courage is high upon the waters. His sweetheart's on the other side of the Nile. How can he make himself plunge in, and even though the crocodile's waiting for him? It is thy love which gives me strength, for thou makest a water spell for me when I see my sister, my sweetheart, coming. Then my heart rejoices. My arms are open wide to embrace her. My heart is glad in this place, like something, Texas broken, eternally. I'd like to know what that was. When my mistress comes to me. Well, not too bad, huh? Not too shabby. That's genuine romantic love. The old heartthrob. The Song of Solomon, as I say here, reflects an ancient concept of romantic love and is evidence that sexuality is a creation of God, is blessed by Him, and that the biblical doctrine of married love permits creativity, spontaneity, and openness while forbidding perversion. It's very interesting to me to us listen to prudish theologians try to explain away the Song of Solomon. You know, it's a metaphor, it's a parable. It's the fanciest one I heard was it's a parable of the relationship between Christ and the church. Well, Song of Solomon is not about Christ and the church. It's about married love. But you see, in the ancient world, they spoke more openly of many things that we have been taught in our culture not to speak so openly about. Not always. I'm not saying that one is good and one is bad. I'm just saying that's the way it was. That is, today, like I say, the Song of Solomon is a very beautiful picture of romantic love between a husband and his wife. Now, the ancients, as I say, spoke very openly. It's interesting that you go to reading the Hebrew, especially, and how the some English translations really strive to render in a delicate way some of the things which are spoken very plainly in Hebrew, having to do with sexuality and some other things. One of my favorite is Elijah. We had a student, Mark Linville, in the earlier years of the school. You know Mark? He's one of the smartest students we ever had. He's still going to graduate school, I think. Mark, working on his doctorate. But Mark, he preached in chapel.
as I recall one time, on Elijah on Mount Carmel. And Elijah was, and when Elijah's mocking the priests of Baal, and he says, "You shout louder. Baal can't hear you. Maybe he's asleep." Or, and then what until that thing, I think the King James says, "Maybe he's covering his feet." But it's the idiom. It means what? He's gone to the toilet. He's on the john. That's very straightforward. But it really captures the spirit of what Elijah was doing. He's saying, "Shout louder! Your God can't hear you. He's in the toilet." So exactly what he said. Well, we try to. What I was saying is that sounds very distasteful or sharp to us. So we like to apply these euphemisms, and many of the statements in the Old Testament are just that way. But the ancients spoke very openly about this. It's not a matter of morals. They simply, now, often what we do is we have a Western modern sensitivity which has been tempered by the code of the Puritans. And there's nothing wrong with this. What I'm simply saying is that we're not talking about morals here. We're talking about a sense of delicateness, what is proper, what we would call proper sensitivities. This is a cultural thing, and we ought not to violate that just for the sake of being straightforward. The price you pay. You'll see what I'm saying. So we're not talking about good or evil here. We're talking about the fact that the point I'm trying to make is that when we read the Song of Solomon, and we read those very explicit statements when he makes about her body, for example, we are embarrassed to read that in the Bible, because we are conditioned to be embarrassed of that and that. And I'm simply saying we should not read the modern complex of sensitivities into the ancient world, because it did not exist then. Now they had their they had their own set. Every culture has these things, which are just theirs, and which, that is, some cultures, ancient and modern, are very sensitive about things that we're open about. And again, it has nothing to do with morals. You understand? What our parents and grandparents would say, that it's improper for polite company. You don't talk about in polite company. Not good or evil, but just what you do or do not talk about in polite company. It varies with cultures. For instance, do you realize in some cultures, it's considered, in India, for instance, it's considered a deep insult if you praise somebody else's children in their presence. You'd say, "What's a beautiful little child you got?" And that would be considered in terrible taste. Well, to us, it would never occur to us. The Orient, have you ever traveled much in the Orient? The Orient has their own set of things that they're sensitive about. Just a matter of the things they speak. For instance, in the Orient, people go to the restroom in a public way that Westerners find disgusting. And to the Orient, it's not disgusting unless you look at them. You know that in Japan, for instance, a person can go to the restroom in public, out in the open, and the rule is you just don't look. And it is not considered insensitive or crude for them to do it, but you are considered crude if you stare at them. The problem is, so there, they don't notice that nobody stares. It's very normal. But when a Westerner goes, they're very shocked at that. And so the Westerner goes, and guess who has looked at that, and who has looked down upon as being crude? Not the fella, out here urinating along the side of the road, but the tourist who's shocked at it. You understand? It's the person who's shocked who is being distasteful. You understand that? So all I'm saying is that in the ancient world,
their set of things about which they would or would not speak of openly was different than the set in the modern world. So let's not, and this idea of trying to read the Song of Solomon because some of the language seems a little bit frank for modern taste, then to try to impose this modern sense of correctness on an ancient document and then explain it away is silly. I think we ought to read it as it stands. That's what it is. Hope I've made that point. It's a not an important one. Let's move on. In Talmudic law, and y'all know what the Talmud is. In Talmudic law, a girl before the age of 12 and a half could not refuse a marriage contract decided upon by her father. It doesn't mean they got married then. It doesn't mean they could drop the they could drop many marriage contracts among these ancient peoples, including the Jews, were drawn up when the child was born. Of course, we don't know when Mary was betrothed to Joseph, do we? It doesn't say that. It says she was betrothed to Joseph. When we first meet them, they're betrothed, they're engaged. That engagement, unless I can't think of any statement in Scripture that kind of that gives an indication, but it was common in that day for those engagements to be made when they're born. Now, the marriage would take place when they came of age. But before 12 and a half, a woman could not refuse a marriage contract decided upon by her father, the Talmud, Jews, Orthodox Jews. After that age, her consent was essential. You think if you waited until after then to make an arrangement, then she had to agree to it. Sepulchral, that is, inscriptions, those on graves, tombs, of Jewish families buried in the catacombs at Rome give the actual ages of brides in six cases. Two married at 12, two at 15, one between 15 and 16, one between 16 and 17. I give you the source on that, Leon's book, The Jews in Ancient Rome. That's not too much under the modern, it's a few years under the modern standards, some of those marriages. But it's pretty young. The Talmud recommended that girls were ready for marriage at puberty, which would be at 12, 12 and a half. Males were advised to marry between 14 and 18. When Greece, to get through this, girls were married as early as 12, but more usually between 14 and 20. There's the Greeks married a little bit later than the Jews did. Men hardly ever married before their service as military ephebes from 18 to 20, and usually away when they were closer to 30. That was the Greek culture, especially the Spartans. The Spartans could not get married before they were 30, or usually did not get married before they were 30. They could not live with, well, I started to say it was, I didn't say it correctly, they could not live with their wives until they had finished this early military service, was about 30. They could get married, but they couldn't live with them. They lived in barracks. So the Jews, the Greeks, delayed marriage for the men. A woman was always subject to a male kurios. What's that word? Lord. A male lord. Or legal guardian. Got that? Now, every woman had to have a male legal guardian in ancient Greece. Now, it could be her father, her husband, a brother, an uncle. But she had to have, she could not... She had no independent legal existence, legal standing. She was therefore the object of marriage negotiations, and her consent was not required. To see, the Greeks had a lower view of women than the Jews did. You understand that? Marriage was viewed as the means for the continuation of families and was not usually the result of romance. Aristotle spoke of the growth of philia, friendship, rather than eros, passionate love between husband and wife. In Plato's Republic, group marriage was to be practiced. As you know, the Republic was an ideal communist society proposed by Plato, in which the natural leaders of the city would rise to the top, the philosopher kings. And among these philosopher kings, they would practice group marriage. He called for this. These ideas, which we saw later in the various communal experiments in America, such as New Harmony and Robert Owen. He writes, and I give you the citation, the source of the Republic. So far then, in regulating the position of women, we may claim to have come safely through one hazardous proposal, that male and female guardians shall have all occupations in common. The consistency of the argument is an assurance that the plan is the good one and is also feasible. We are like swimmers who have breasted the first wave without being swallowed up. They said, we go over one heavy barrier, and that is that Male and female guardians have all occupations in common. That is, men and women share equally in taking care of children. But now he said, if we go over one wave, we've got another one that might drown us. Not such a small wave either. You will not call it large when you see the next. Let me have a look at the next one then. What's our next problem? Here it is. A law which follows from that principle and all that has gone before, namely that of these guardians, no one man and one woman are to set up house together privately. Wives are to be held in common by all. So too are the children. And no parent is to know his own child, nor any child his parent. Now that's genuine group marriage. It would be much harder to convince people that that is either a feasible plan or a good one. He says, we're going to have a tough time getting this plan across. I would point out he never got that plan across. It was never put into practice. As to its being a good plan, I imagine no one would deny the immense advantage of wives and children being held in common, provided it can be done. I should expect dispute to arise chiefly over the question of whether it's possible. In other words, he said, surely everybody will agree that it's desirable. Now, whether it's possible to work it out is another question. Let me say, this is true collectivism. Let me finish and I'll make my comments on it. There may well be a good deal of dispute over both points. Yeah, there was. You mean I must meet a tax on two fronts? I was hoping to escape one by running away. If you agreed it was a good plan, then I should have only had to inquire whether it was feasible. No, I must pay the penalty for my cowardice. But grant me one favor. Let me indulge my fancy like one who entertains himself with idle daydreams on a solitary walk. And he's saying, I have no real hope of getting this through. But he says it's an ideal plan. Got to have a group marriage. Now let me say about, this is important to us today. This is a part of the package of collectivism. Plato's Republic is a collectivist document. You know what collectivism is? Collectivism is a view of, it's a political theory, it's a worldview, that says that the good of the majority outweighs, in every case, the right of the individual. That is, that personal freedom must be sacrificed to the general welfare, the general good, collectivism. Now, America started out as an individualist society. We have rapidly become a collectivist society. Of course, communism is collectivism. For the good of the whole, the individual does not enjoy an individual existence. Now, and it is a part of collectivism that the home is the enemy of collectivism. I think you ought to know this. I'm talking about Christian home. I'll teach you something very important here. The view that I think you have of the Christian home, we are considered the enemy by academic collectivists in America and by political collectivists around the world. Why? Because, see, the home is the last bastion, it's the last holdout of an individualist society. Here's the question. I'll give an example. Here's the question. Who has the primary right over my children or your children?
Insurance.
Do you have, or does the state have? That is, must I give up my rights to my children for the general welfare? Now, collectivists would say that, collectivism will break down. It cannot exist in a society, it cannot prosper in a society and cannot win the victory if a large number of the homes in that society exist on the basis of the parental ownership, in effect, of children and of the first loyalties being in the home. You see, if a person has primary loyalties in the home, then their primary loyalties cannot be to the state. You cannot have two sets of primary loyalties. You have a primary and a secondary. And because The Christian home says, the Bible, that the biblical view is that the primary loyalty is to the home, the parents, that is, apart from the loyalty to God, then we are the enemy of collectivism. You have to break that bond for a collectivist state to work. If I may, am I talking gibberish to you guys? That is, if, see, a collectivist state to work must create homogeneity. That is, it must create people who march to the same drumbeat, who work together, who are socially adjusted, as it said. And see, this is one of the modern, ever since John Dewey and some others, the primary purpose of the public school system is to create citizens who fit in, who are functioning members of society, they will say, who are in harmony with society, who will fit in, who will be homogeneous with the rest of society. That's why, for instance, and who will be therefore socially well adjusted and all the rest. Secondarily, we hope they can read and write. And one of the reasons why the public school system, I'm not criticizing public school teachers, I think public school teachers are better than the system. The fundamental purpose of the public school system has not been basic education, it's been to socialize students. They went through a thing in the 60s, they've had to back off on this a little bit, although the theory is still there, but you didn't give F's. I can remember some schools didn't give F's anymore. Why? Because everybody was passing? No, because you see, if you fail a student, you would create a sense of low self-esteem. He would tend not to be a well-adjusted member of society. So if you have to choose between giving him an honest grade, or if he failed the course, well, the rule was nobody failed. So what they did for several years, they just passed students on, could not pass the courses. But they wouldn't fail them. Why? Because, you see, if they had to choose between giving them an education and making them socially well-adjusted, it was better than they had to choose to making them to like to be socially well-adjusted, which you could not do if you failed them. Of course, it was an illusion, the whole thing, and they've had been forced back away from that. You realize that to go back to giving grades, and we had to go back to giving grades and back to try to make more education. But that's one of the reasons why so many connected with the National Education Association, their position is we must shut down the Christian schools. Why? Well, because the Christian schools are not going to create this socially adjusted person who's going to fit into the collectivist society. If you say to them, you ever notice this, Jim, you're probably familiar with this, as you know, the tests show that kids who go to the Christian schools get better grades on the standardized tests than the kids who go to the public schools. And have you noticed that the professional educators don't care? You say, it doesn't mean a thing to them. You say to them, well, these kids can read and write better. Well, they care. It's not the point of the public school system, reading and writing better. What they say, here's what they always say is, yes, and I've read that, yes, but those kids who go to that Christian school, how are they going to fit into society? That's the question. I say, that's not the question. The question is, can they read and write? That's the question. Not do they fit into society. And you see the difference? Well, so it is with the home, the Christian home. Plato's Republic, this is collectivism. You see, what if the parents are teaching children things that will cause them not to fit in perfect harmony with society, not to be a part of the collectivist mass? Well, then you see the children must be taken out of the home. If that's the theory, at least. That's why Plato wrote this up, as he knew he could not have his republic if there was this bond of primary loyalty between parent and child.
This lower view of women is also seems to come through in this, where it looks, at least from reading this part of the text, any man can demand of any woman, and yet I don't see anywhere.
Yes.
It says all women belong to the men, and yet it never makes a statement.
It's not reciprocal. No. Well,
Do you have any questions on what I just said? That's it ought to be very important to us.
Is this the idea, the old idea, the way you control society is through ignorance?
Well,
they're trying to make everyone ignorant to control them.
No, they're not trying to keep them ignorant. They're trying to keep them educated in the right things. In the right things.
They don't care if they can hear you right.
Well, that's, you see, they care. They want them to be able to read and write. That's not their primary concern. And they've that's why now they're being forced back to a more realistic view. But you read what they say. For instance, let me give you an example. How are you going to create a child who's an internationalist, who agrees with the modern secularists that the ideal world is a one world government? That's what we want. One world economy, one world government. That's the most efficient. One world money. We've got to have that. And primary loyalty to the state and collectivist society for the good of everyone. Raise everybody up to the average. Well, you can't have that if you've got a school or a home that's teaching children primary loyalty to America, that America is a superior country, that we don't want to share our cultural wealth with their cultural property. I'm talking about money now. And we believe in God, all kinds of things. What's the real? That's the debate now. Whose kids are these? Plato tried to break. Plato knew, my point is, he would have to break that bond if he was going to have his collectivist society. Hence, group marriage. And modern collectivists know exactly the same thing, which is my point. Well, in Rome, let's move on. Well, that's a whole big section of it. We'll stop there. Okay.